Okay, welcome back. Another week. I'll share the screen. If you want to open up a Chumash, it is Chumash Shmos, and we are Perek Lamed Gimel, chapter 33 in Chumash Shmos, which is in Parshas Kisisa. And it is, just 1 second, yes, and we are going to start inside from Pasuk Vav, which is verse 6. But just to make a quick review to where we are, this is actually quite a, I don't know if I should use the word complicated, but it's an interesting chapter which many of the commentaries grapple exactly the flow of the chapter as we're seeing so far and really where it comes in. Because as we said, the Jews, you know, they've sinned. Hashem has semi-forgiven them. It's in the process of being forgiven. Moshe Rabbeinu is still having a conversation with Hashem about the forgiveness. But this perek has a few odds and ends thrown in, whereas we saw last week that Hashem says to Moshe that he personally won't lead them into Israel. He'll send a malach, and Moshe doesn't like that. The idea that the Jewish people are also devastated by the fact that Hashem won't actually be revealed in their midst. They take off their crowns, and we discussed what the crowns represent. We discussed Hashem's anger. And then we started a little bit to discuss Moshe Rabbeinu himself. That's where it's going to take a little bit of a turn now. And we're going to see something fascinating today, which is, as I say, the flow is a little bit hard to understand, but we'll do our best, where Moshe Rabbeinu is having quite a conversation with Hashem. And amongst the conversation that we're having is certain actions that Moshe does do, and that's in front of the Jewish people. But then he turns to Hashem and he has certain questions, if you want to say, and certain demands and requests. And yeah, so we'll see how it all flows. This part of the Chumash chapter 33 is quite a famous perek in the sense where it says that this is where Moshe Rabbeinu, and we're going to touch on it today, hopefully we'll get to more than just touching on it, is where Moshe Rabbeinu asks Hashem some of the most fundamental philosophical questions which have bothered people throughout all the generations up until today. The same questions, we are the same people, interestingly enough, even though times have changed, but we still have very similar experiences. Why do good people suffer? Why does it seem that so many bad people seem to have such a good life? All the different philosophical questions, how we can attain the closeness, how we can actually know and understand God's ways. And we're going to see this is part of what Moshe Rabbeinu asks Hashem and yearns to understand, and we have to understand how that fits in. So just to come a step back, as we saw last week, the Jewish people had removed their crowns and they were devastated about the fact that Hashem wasn't going to be revealed. And then we did mention I don't know if I muted. Just 1 second, I'll come. Let me just mute everybody. And sorry. Okay. Yes, I'm just going to share the screen again. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So here we have, and we did read this puzzle, but I just want to start from here and we'll go into depth to see now what happens. V'haya kitzeis Moshe el ha'ayel, and it was when Moshe would go out to the tent, yakumu kol ha'am, the entire nation would stand up, ish pesach alai, each man at the entrance of his tent, v'hibitu achrei Moshe, and they would look, so to speak, look, hibitu is a strong word, it's that they would actually gaze, they would look hard after Moshe, ad bayay ha'ayala, until he would enter into the tent. I'm sorry, I should have read the pasuk zayin. Sorry, let me just go back for 1 minute, because this is the, so to speak, the beginning of this part. Moshe took the tent, and it's not clear what this means, but we say that it means his personal tent, or at least it means the tent where he would converse with Hashem, which we referred to last time. We said it's called, he called it the Ohel Moed, the place of meeting, the place where he would have his revelation of godliness. And he took this tent, and he actually pitched it outside of the camp, which means that he's now a little bit of a distance from the Jewish people, as it says, at a distance. at a distance could imply that he's making a space between himself and the people. And that's true, because he felt, if the people don't deserve to have Hashem revealed, maybe I won't deserve to have Hashem revealed to me if I remain in the camp. And Moshe obviously wanted to have conversations and revelations and needed guidance from Hashem. So he thought he was doing the right thing by taking his tent away from the impure, so to speak, camp, and removing it and putting it in a place which was at a distance. But the other thing that Harchek also shows us is that the distance was very specific. It says that he moved the tent only a distance, not too far away, the distance that they were permitted to walk on Shabbos. Because, you know, on Shabbos there is a certain amount of steps you're allowed to take outside of the camp, 2,000 mil, whatever it is. And Moshe Rabbeinu made sure to pitch his tent at a distance where the Jewish people can still come to him or still see him or still engage on Shabbos. So it was a distance, but not such a great distance. And he called it the Oyel Mayed, as we mentioned last time. Oyel Mayed signifies, Mayed is like what we call Yontif, a Mayed, which means that's in a way almost a negative thing. It's almost like now he's saying to the people, because of what you did, Hashem is only there at designated times. Or Oyel Mayed actually signifies, this is a place where I can meet with Hashem, I can converse with Hashem, dedicated to Hashem, free from all defilement. V'haya kol mevakesh Hashem, and it was anybody who was seeking Hashem, Yetzei el Oyel Mayed, would go out to this tent, Asher michutz lamachane, which was outside of the camp. We mentioned last time, this signifies for all generations that when a person is seeking God, which most of us in our life, at some point, we seek God, we seek clarity, we seek closeness to Hashem, the only way to do it is actually to leave the camp, which means that we have to leave our comfort zone. Sometimes we have to leave our regular, normal environment, go out, get inspired, and then bring that inspiration back into our home. There is a concept of a person have a goyla l'makim Torah. There's a concept of people going away from home to learn in a yeshiva. And that comes from this idea also, that it is a very valuable and an important thing for a person to travel in order to seek godliness. But more than that, it says, v'haya kol mevakesh Hashem. This is very beautiful. The language is very exact. What Moshe, it was very interesting what's happening. It's like this dual thing that's happening here. On the one hand, Moshe's sort of making a little bit of a distance between himself and the people. And yet on the other hand, he's ensuring that he's still accessible. And this word, v'haya kol mevakesh Hashem, means anybody who seeks Hashem, it doesn't matter what they've done until now, it doesn't matter where they are and who they are, they can come and seek and find Hashem. All they have to do is Yetzei el Oyel Mayed, out to the Oyel Mayed, Asher Michutz Lamachane. Okay, I think we discussed that last week, and let's see now V'hoya. So now when Moshe Rabbeinu did that, what would happen is, so very interesting, so he would go out to the tent, and the Mefarshim say, what does that mean? He would go, I'm just looking over here, oh yeah, Rashi just said, L'leches el Oyel, when he would go out to the tent, which means he would leave, he would actually mingle with the people. And we'll see soon, what does that mean, he would mingle? First of all, he would mingle with the people, but more than that, every time he had a revelation of godliness, or Hashem would, especially when Hashem would teach him something, what Moshe Rabbeinu would do is he would go into the camp, because he would have to teach that which he had been taught to the elders, and to Aaron, and to the other Kohanim, and so forth. So he was constantly going back and forth. So it says when he would go back to the tent, l'leches el Oyel, it's a very beautiful imagery to imagine this. What would happen is that the entire nation, all the people, would rise and stand, each ish pesach alay, this is in Pasuk Ches, each man at the entrance of his tent, v'hibitu acharei Moshe, and as we said, they would gaze after Moshe, until he arrived, until he went into his tent. In other words, until they couldn't see him anymore. So you can see that the distance wasn't so far. It was sort of visible to some of the people, at least. But this is a very beautiful idea. What was it? Why were they gazing after Moshe? So it's very interesting. First of all, it says, Rashi tells us, They stood up, they would stand before him and not sit down until he was concealed from them. This was out of tremendous respect and love of Moshe Rabbeinu for most of the people. That's what the feeling was. The other thing it says is that v'hibitu acharei Moshe, what does it mean that they would look, so to speak, and gaze? So Rashi says, these are words, lashevach, praise. Ashrei yilud isha, praised is the one who, a person who was born of a woman, in other words, a human being, shekach muftach, that is so assured, shehashchina tikoneis acharav lepesach alei, that the Shechina follows him to the entrance of his tent and stays there. And this was Moshe Rabbeinu, who knew that when he would come to the Ohel Moed, as he called it, there's no question that the Shechina would follow him, the Shechina would be there, and that he had access to have conversation and revelation of godliness. And this was something that the people were never, they could never like get enough of. It was just such an awe-inspiring vision for them. That's how Rashi puts it. Now, there is another way, almost the opposite way of looking at this pasuk, and they say, you see the word that it uses, kol ha'am. Who is the am? Remember, we've mentioned before, when it uses the word am, a lot of times it doesn't mean the regular, you know, the masses, the Jewish people. Rather, it means the Erev Rav. The Erev Rav, those people who were the negative, you know, the ones who were always looking to complain. What were they looking for? And this was so sad. They were looking and scrutinizing and trying to find fault in Moshe Rabbeinu. And some of the Mefarshim say, to such an extent, and unfortunately, as I say, things haven't changed, Moshe Rabbeinu was a leader. And as we mentioned, Moshe Rabbeinu was quite wealthy, and then he became even more wealthy soon. So what happens is that these people who were looking for something negative, scrutinized and said, oh, you know, Moshe, he looks very well fed today. Doesn't he look like he's dressing well? And it's all from our money, or he's, you know, whatever it is. They found something negative and disparaging to say about Moshe Rabbeinu constantly. And that's what they were gazing at him for. And it's actually interesting. So there's two opposite ways of looking at it. And some of the commentaries say that they're both true, because it depended who you were. Some people were looking for good, and therefore they saw good. And some people are looking for negative, and therefore what they saw is negative. So that's unfortunately what would happen, or fortunately. Just want to see, there was other beautiful thing before we go further from this pasuk. Okay, just to see in the actual, sorry, just give me 1 minute, because I want to show, I wanted to read you, very beautiful thing. The Abarbanel says so magnificently. He says it beautifully, that if you look at it, it says that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he would go out of the tent, all the people would stand, right? And they would watch him go, right? So it's very, very interesting that what would happen is that Moshe Rabbeinu would be, if you want to say, their gaze, the way they looked at him, that was the accompaniment. The truth is that what the Jewish people in the ideal wanted was they wanted actually to be able to physically follow Moshe. But Moshe, first of all, to go in front of them, that they couldn't do, right? They knew that Moshe had to be first. But even to follow behind, Moshe didn't let, because he was so humble. He didn't want to be like accompanied by this whole entourage, all the honor and the glory, so to speak. So all the people could do is follow him with their eyes. And that was the way they showed him tremendous honor. Just want to see, and very interesting is that all the time that Moshe Rabbeinu lived, so the people would follow him with their eyes, and Yehoshua, as we know, we'll see it, I'll mention him soon, he remained in the tent. And this was his way of honoring Moshe, that he was literally there, always ready to serve Moshe. But not only that, very interesting thing is that Moshe Rabbeinu, as we said, when he would come to the tent, he would come with the Shechina, right? So the revelation of godliness. And yet he was able to walk, no problem, and come back and forth, and he didn't lose his strength. But Yehoshua, even though he was in the tent, and he also obviously got a very big glimpse, more than just a glimpse, but he also had some of the revelation, not the same degree of revelation that Moshe Rabbeinu had, but he had some. But even the smaller amount of revelation of godliness caused Yehoshua to be not to be able to move. That's because it was so great for him. So it shows us the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu, that despite the fact that it was such a high level of revelation, he was able to come, he was able to go. It was almost like Hashem, and we'll see soon, is the right word is not a friend, but he's like in such an enclosed relationship with Moshe that he comes with Moshe, he goes with Moshe, he talks to Moshe at all times. Okay, now, and it describes a little bit more here. The pasuk says, I just want to see one more little thing. The Malbim says also beautifully, what was it that they were gazing? Why were they gazing, so to speak, with such a strong look? And the Malbim says it very beautiful. It's hard for me to share so many screens, but I'll just read it to you as best as I can. The Malbim says, "Kidei she'al yodai yichol aleihem ruach kedusha v'tahara." That through Moshe Rabbeinu, what they were hoping was that it should rest upon them also holiness and purity. Kederech Misha Oimed Lifnei HaNavi V'ish HaRuach. Like we know, if you stand in front of a prophet, you some of his holiness, if you want to say it's contagious in a good way, some of his holiness also comes on you. And this is what the Jewish people wanted. The other thing that the Malbim says is why they were gazing, because they were looking very carefully, scrutinizing how Moshe Rabbeinu acts. Why? Because they said, if we can know B'darkei Moshe u'b'midaisav lihiyos kamayu, then we will know how to be like him, how to act in his way, and that's the best example of how we want to learn how to live. So this was all the different reasons why they're looking, so to speak. The idea is to learn exactly how to model his behavior. And then in Pasuk Tes, V'haya kevay Moshe ayala, and it would be that when Moshe entered the tent, Yered Amud Ha'anan, the pillar of cloud would descend, V'amad Pesach Ha'ayal, and stand at the entrance of the tent, V'diber im Moshe, and it would speak with Moshe. So this is very interesting. Rashi even comments here, it sounds like, it's like a conversation, Moshe and Hashem, almost two equals. It's a little bit interesting that the Torah put it that way. And Rashi says, K'may u'medaber im Moshe, it's as if he would speak in the present tense to Moshe. But Rashi also brings from the Unkelus, Targum, and he says like this, that the truth is that the way we want to say that, the best way to say it in an honorable way to Hashem is that Vayishma es hakol medaber elav, which means that what would happen is that Hashem would be speaking and Moshe would, so to speak, overhear, if you want to say. It's not like there was a direct speaking back and forth. Rather, it's like Hashem was speaking to himself and Moshe could eavesdrop, if you want to say. Moshe could listen in to the conversation. So it's a little bit, that's why he uses that word. He says, v'diber im Moshe, and he would speak and then with Moshe. So you put, like he would speak to himself, and Moshe was able to overhear, so to speak, to listen in on the conversation. Okay, just want to see. Okay, and now another beautiful thing that the Malbim says also. It's interesting how it describes it, that the Anan, the cloud, which is actually the godliness, so to speak, the Shechina, would be standing, so to speak, at the entrance to Moshe Rabbeinu's tent. Why? It's interesting that it's not that they went inside and then conversed, it was sort of at the entrance. And this was Dafka, the Malbim says, because what it did was it enabled all the Jewish people who were looking and gazing to also be able not to have a direct conversation the way Moshe, but to direct their tefillos to the Shechina. And they felt like the Shechina was present there. So it was actually a gift to the Jewish people that the Shechina remained, in a sense, at the entrance as opposed to inside, where they couldn't at all have any realization that it's there. Obviously, they didn't get the same revelation Moshe did, but they were aware of the fact that the Shechina is there. Okay. And then the pasuk continues with the reaction. You see, v'ra'a kol ha'am es amud ha'anan. So when the Jewish people would see the pillar of cloud, oimed pesach ha'ayel, that was standing at the entrance of the tent, again, v'kam kol ha'am, it couldn't help but inspire them, and it would make them stand up, v'hishtachavu ish pesach ha'alai, and they would prostrate themselves, they would bow, each one at the entrance to his tent. Obviously, they were not bowing to Moshe Rabbeinu, they were not bowing to the cloud, they were bowing to Hashem, who they realized his presence was there. The example that's given, it's like when we take out the Sefer Torah, obviously, we're not giving honor to the beautiful cover, we're not giving honor, what we're giving honor to is the godliness which is found within the Sefer Torah. And that's what the Jewish people did, and this was such a magnificent thing for them to have this presence, this ability to have this, even this degree of revelation. Just want to see. Oh, just one interesting thing. It says that it's quite, remember we said before, unfortunately, the negative, you know, there's always the positive and there's the negative, you know, there's all kinds of people. So for most of the people, it was just such an incredible inspiration, and they felt such respect of Moshe Rabbeinu, and it inspired and it lifted them to also want to come close to Hashem. But of course, there are the people that are ever critical, and they would just find ways of criticizing Moshe. So it's an interesting thing that one of the Lashon Haras that it said that people spoke about Moshe was that Moshe Rabbeinu, he's not even faithful to his wife. So the Alshich says that's so far removed. It's like, you know, you talk Lashon Hara, but Lashon Hara has to have some, you know, connection to the person. People don't say something which has zero connection. So where does that come in? So the Alshich says such a magnificent thing, and he says that actually he heard it from somebody, Rab Shimon Mahalchai, Hashem Yitzra Nishmasai, somebody that he knew, the Alshich HaKadosh says. He says that what were they suspicious of? They were suspicious, ki mekabel nuvu asai mehamalach. What they said was, you think he's talking directly to Hashem? Moshe's not talking directly to Hashem. He is talking to an intermediary. We don't realize it, but in the tent, there's a malach. And the malach is passing on the message of what Hashem is saying. Because even Moshe can't hear Hashem directly. That's like that kind of, if you want to say, second wife that Moshe Rabbeinu has. It's an intermediary, an angel. And that's what the people were saying, and that those negative people who were looking to criticize. And obviously, that wasn't true, because that's what the Pasuk tells us in Pasuk Yud Aleph. V'diber Hashem el Moshe, and Hashem spoke to Moshe, ponim el ponim. This is very, very strong language in these psukim. We don't have it in many places in the Chumash, but here we see the relationship between Moshe Rabbeinu and Hashem face to face. We'll see later, obviously, Moshe can't see Hashem's face. But here what we mean by ponim el ponim, it means that they spoke to each other like on the same level, like you would be comfortable, like when you speak to somebody that you feel that you have a connection to, but not just a connection, but you can actually have a proper relationship. And what the Mefarshim say is ponim el ponim is a beautiful language. It means that Moshe was so lifted, so elevated, that he was almost, if you want to say, he could talk to Hashem face to face. You know, if you speak to somebody who's much greater, you always say, like, you look up to them, so your face is lower. Here we see Moshe was able to talk to Hashem in a sense where he's facing him almost on his level, obviously not on Hashem's level, but in a sense where he's so comfortable and so able to have such a deep connection to Hashem. That's because he's so refined and so elevated, and been so chosen by Hashem, ponim el ponim, as he says, ka'asher yidaber ish el re'ehu, as a man would speak to his friend, vishov el hamachane, and then he would return to the tent, umisharso Yahushua, to the camp, sorry, umisharso Yahushua bin Nun, nar, well, let's see in a minute what that means. So his servant, so to speak, his attendant, Yahushua, was a lad, lo yomish mitaycha ayel, he never moved from the tent. Okay, before we go to the second part of the pasuk, because it's an interesting flow, this whole pasuk, how does it make sense? I just want to analyze, just see something here. It says, ponim el ponim. So I wanted to see, there's a beautiful, beautiful idea over here that when we talk about panim el panim, this actually shows us something about our relationship, and generally speaking, we know. Okay. You know that it, very interesting thing we say that when a person is close to another person, and you know in the Ksuvim we have the beautiful pasuk Kamayim haponim laponim kein leiv haadam laadam, just like a person, you know, one person's face is reflected, so too is your heart reflected. What that means is that just like it's just the way you feel towards somebody else, that mirrors back and that person feels that way towards you. Okay, so we know that generally that's how it works with two people. When you meet somebody, most of the time we can sense inside if they want to be there. Do they want to be talking to us? Do they want to see us? Or are they just there because they have to be there? As soon as we sense that somebody actually cares about us, that actually evokes in us also that feeling that we care about them. So the Mefarshim say that this is what was happening over here, that Moshe Rabbeinu, it went both ways, Moshe Rabbeinu felt that Hashem actually loved him, that Hashem believed in him, and therefore he felt comfortable to talk to Hashem as a man does to his friend. And it says, the Mefarshim says, it's interesting because it goes both ways. Sometimes we have to start our relationship, you know, by doing the right thing, if you want to say, bringing ourselves closer to Hashem, and then Hashem responds. But also, sometimes if a person feels that they've a certain closeness, a certain inspiration, it's because Hashem is looking at you and wanting you, so to speak. It's because of the love that Hashem is expressing to you. You might not see it, but inside you feel it. And when you feel that love, what that does is it actually wakes up in you that you want to respond and you want to relate to Hashem. And this is what was happening here. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, actually, this is a very good gauge. I know that Hashem is happy. How come I know Hashem is happy with me? And we'll see why that makes a difference soon. Because I feel that I can speak to him. I feel that I can connect to him on this level. Okay, but there is another opinion about Panim El Panim. And this is so the opposite, it's interesting. Some Mefarshim say that panim sometimes is used as a word for anger. That when you use the word panim, it means that Hashem is showing an angry face. Why would Hashem be angry? So very interesting thing. It says, we just mentioned how Moshe Rabbeinu moved his tent out of the camp. He did it because he felt that he was afraid that if he keeps his tent in the camp, he won't be able to speak to Hashem, or he won't have the revelations that he needs to have, and he won't be able to find out all the things he needs to find out. But Hashem wasn't happy. The Mefarshim say that Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, it's not enough for the Jewish people that I have rejected them. Now you are also rejecting them. This is devastating for them. I am not revealed anymore, right? As we know, they had to take off their crowns because they did the sin of the golden calf. But also you are going? That's not a good idea. And that's why the pasuk flows, Vishov el hamachane. So when Moshe Rabbeinu heard that, so he said, oh, I better return. I better go back to the camp. Hashem said to Moshe, yes, that's a good idea. And Moshe felt, I will go back to the camp so that I can be with the Jewish people, but I will leave my attendant Yeshua. He will remain permanently in the tent. So therefore, there was a very fascinating thing that was happening. Moshe was going back and forth so that the Jewish people shouldn't feel abandoned. And yet Moshe Rabbeinu didn't feel that was disrespectful because he left his attendant there, Yeshua, to be a permanent constant there in the tent where Hashem would rest his presence. Very interesting. It says, Yeshua bin Nun Na'ar. Was he a Na'ar? How old was he here? And this is fascinating. The Mefarshim say that if you make a cheshbon, you can figure out that Yeshua was actually 56 years old here. So I guess Torah has an interesting way of what he calls a youth, a lad. Why was he called a lad if he's 56? How do we get to that cheshbon of him being 56? So it says that Yeshua lived until the age of 110. And we know that's when he passed away, when he was 110 years old. This is the beginning of the 40 years. So take off 40 years, because Yeshua, we know, passed away when they already entered the land of Israel. But 40 years of the desert means 70. And then another 14 years when he took them into the land to divide and conquer. So that leaves you that he over here, he's 56 years old. Why is he called a lad if he's 56 years old? So the Mefarshim say a very beautiful thing. First of all, because he served Moshe so devotedly, he was so, his whole life was just about whatever Moshe Rabbeinu needs. So he was like a lad to the master Moshe. So that's one way. The other thing it says, just simply the Ramban says that anytime somebody is a master and somebody's serving them, the one who's serving is called a lad. So he's like the second, he's like lower in a sense. But Bin Nun, this is also interesting. You know, we say it, we don't even think about it because we're so used to it. But really, when you say somebody's name, you don't say Yeshua Bin Nun, you say Yeshua Ben Nun. What's the idea of Bin Nun? Where does that come from, B with a chirik? It's a funny language. And as the Ramban says, how come not even in one place in the Chumash does it say Ben? It's true sometimes it calls people Bin maybe, but at least once it should say Ben. No, nowhere Ben. Because this symbolizes something very, very beautiful. I want to read you the words. It says, because Yeshua was such a special tzaddik, it says like this. They used to call him this in honor, like as an honorable name. Why? Because first of all, Bin Nun, you can put together the words Bin Nun, and Bin Nun is like Bina, understanding. Ki einavain v'chacham kamayu, because there was nobody as wise and as understanding as Yeshua. Or they actually were giving him a blessing in a sense every time they said Bin Nun, which meant that the Bina should continue. Nun is from the word continue. It should continue and continue and continue. What they're blessing Yeshua is that he should, as a faithful, loyal servant of Moshe Rabbeinu, he should continue growing, continue learning from Moshe, and that his Bina, his understanding, will continue and get more and more and greater and greater. And he, as we said, didn't stay, move himself from the tent. And that's why this is not, we're not going to discuss that now, but that's why later on we know that when it came time that Moshe Rabbeinu did have to pass away, the Jewish people were not left alone. They were left with a very faithful and a very capable replacement in Yeshua. Okay, let's see now. Now we come to a very, as I said, very almost personal side point here. Because now we're going to have a very interesting conversation. And this is something, like I said, that the Mefarshim grapple a little how this comes in over here. Because if we put this in context, we're still in the, Moshe Rabbeinu is still in the middle of gaining forgiveness for the Jewish people. Okay, that's what he's doing. He hasn't yet gotten forgiveness. This is still the middle 40 days. And really it's about the Jewish people and defending them. And yet Moshe seems to take a little bit of a sidetrack. And I'll read you a few of the psukim, and then we'll see some of the depth here. Vayomer Moshe el Hashem, and Moshe Rabbeinu says to Hashem, Re'ei ata oimer elai, look, you say to me, Ha'ales ha'om hazeh, bring up this nation. Ata loy haydatani eis asher tishlach, but you haven't told me who you're going to send with me. Ata amarta yidai ticha b'shem, and you told me that you've known me by name, v'gamatzosa chein be'enai, and you have also found favor in my eyes. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu says that Hashem said about him. In other words, that I am special when he says yidai tiv b'shem. It's very interesting. It's, do you remember at the beginning when Hashem met Moshe, when the first time where Moshe had an encounter with Hashem, Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, to the Avais, I only revealed myself with the name Shakai, but to you, I reveal myself with the name Yudke Vovke, which is a much greater revelation, right? That's what Moshe Rabbeinu is saying. You revealed yourself to me with such a great name. And not only that, but you kept on telling me that I have found favor in your eyes, but still you haven't told me who you're sending to take the Jewish people, because before we said, Hashem said, I'm not going. But it's a funny question here, because Hashem did say, he said, I'm sending a malach. So let's see what Rashi says. Rashi says, he says, direct your eyes and your heart on your words. In other words, like you're saying to Hashem, think about what you said. Like, I'm trying to understand. Ata aimere la, you said to me such and such about the fact that you're not going to go with us, right? Then you're leaving us, and we're a stubborn nation. And if I'm with you, I'm going to get angry. And what about the fact that you did say to me, you're sending an angel? Ein zu hayda, Moshe Rabbeinu says, that is not considered informing. Why? It's a very strong language here. She'ein ani chafetz ba, because I don't want this. In other words, it's almost as if you didn't even say it. I'm not buying it. That's not part of the conversation. That's not even an option. You said you're sending an angel. No, you didn't say anything if you said that. We're not moving until you, Hashem, yourself, joins us, accompanies us, is with us in all of our travels and all of our journeys. So quite a powerful language that Moshe Rabbeinu is using. And you can see he's almost backing it up by saying, you know, Hashem, it sounds a little bit chutzpahdik, but I can do it because you've already expressed that I'm special, so to speak. Not me personally, right? He's not, Moshe Rabbeinu is humble, but at this time in the Jewish people's, because as he's saying, he wants Hashem with the Jewish people, this time of the Jewish people's time in history, if you want to say, they've been elevated, and I've revealed myself with my name, and that I found favor. So where are you? That's Rashi's approach. Some of the other Mefarshim, the Ibn Ezra, the Ramban, actually say that when Moshe Rabbeinu says to Hashem, you haven't told me who you're going to send, what it means is not that you didn't tell me, because you did say you're going to send a malach, but you didn't specify which malach. And to Moshe Rabbeinu, that wasn't good enough. Why? Because according to the Ramban, Moshe Rabbeinu wanted only, he would agree only on certain terms. If it was a certain malach, which malach would he agree? So some of Hashem say if it was the malach Michal. Why? The malach Michal, we know, is the malach of chesed, of kindness. But what that represents also is the malach Michal has Hashem's name in it. And the malach Michal is the one who would be able to lead the Jewish people higher than nature. Moshe Rabbeinu says to Hashem, you know, this people that you have chosen, so to speak, the Jewish people, and you've given them the Torah, and we'll see in a minute he expresses this even stronger. You have chosen them, and you have made them your exclusive nation. Now, you can't just throw them back to become a regular nation, which is under the rule of nature. They have to remain a nation which works supernaturally. And if that's not the case, I don't agree. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu says. Very powerful language that he's using. So either Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't agree to any intermediary, any malach, or if he does, it's only a specific malach. And we're going to come back a little bit to understand Moshe Rabbeinu also what he wants from Hashem. But just to read a few more psukim. Ve'ata im no matzasi chein beinecha. So now, if I have indeed found favor in your eyes, Haydi eini na estrachecha. This is very strong language. We're going to look in the Gemara in a minute to see what Moshe Rabbeinu is asking for. Let me know your ways. Ve'eida acha, that I may know you. Leman emtza chein be'einecha, so that I might find favor in your eyes. Ure'ei ki amcha hagoy hazeh. And consider that this nation is your people, is your people, is your nation. Okay, I want to show you what Rashi says, but we're going to look into the Gemara and see it more at length. What does this mean? What's Moshe Rabbeinu asking for here? This is really a very big ask. Moshe Rabbeinu wants Hashem to explain to him how he operates. What's the way Hashem operates in this world? He wants to know Hashem. Look at this, know your ways. V'ata, he says, if it's true, first, Im emes shematzasi chein beinecha, that I found favor in your eyes. Haydi eini na estrachecha, let me know your ways. Mas charataneisen lemaitze chein beinecha, what reward do you give those who find favor in your eyes? This is a very layered question, because it doesn't just mean what reward. Rather, do the people who find favor in your eyes always get a reward that they can feel as a reward? And we'll see what that means. A very big fundamental question, philosophical question that Moshe is asking. He says, Ve'eda bazem midas tagmulecha. And this I will know the standard of your recompense. Mahi mitzias chein. What is it? What constitutes finding favor? Upisren leman emtza chein. Since I have found favor, right? So if I found favor, I have to know what that means. What does it mean, I have found favor? What's the reward? What does it doesn't mean just reward. He means, what's the way that you behave towards somebody who finds favor in your eyes? And why do I want to know that? And according to most Mefarshim, Moshe Rabbeinu says, because this way I will know how to relate to you. I will know how to continue living my life. I will know how to behave, how what to do, what not to do, how to view, how to understand the way the whole world runs. Now, there's another, just one Rashi before we go back to look into the Gemara and understand the real questions that Moshe is asking here. So Rashi says something interesting. He says, "Ure'ei ki amcha agayazeh." You see, Moshe Rabbeinu stresses again, and consider that this nation is your people. Why is he specifying again, this nation is your people? Because here he says, Moshe is telling Hashem, Shalei Tomar, that you shouldn't say, "Ve'esa oischa l'goy gadol," like Hashem already said to Moshe, don't worry about the people. I'll make you into a great nation. In other words, believe them, and now you will start a new nation. Ves Eila Tazov, and we'll leave these on the side. Urei ki amcha hemi ketem. No, these people are your original people from long ago. Ve'im bahem timas, and if you reject them, eini soimech al hayotzi michaltzei sheyiskaimu, then I can't rely, I can't trust on those who will come out of me that you won't reject them. In other words, if you reject these people now, how can I be secure and know that my children and that my grandchildren will also not be rejected in the future if chas v'shalom they don't act the right way? As we say, he says, I want to know, he says, make known to me the payment of my reward through these people. Rashi tells us something very interesting. Rashi says, really, to understand these psukim, you must open up the Gemara. You can't do without it. Rashi says, it's not my place to explain to you exactly what the Gemara is, but I'm recommending that you look it up. And we're going to see in 1 minute what the Gemara is. I just want to see one more. Let's look now at the Gemara. So I'm going to open up that. It's Gemara Brachis. So I'm just going to stop this share and I'll go to that one. Yeah, here we are. Okay, so this is Gemara Brachas. As you can see, it's Daf Zayin, which is 7a, and very, very fascinating. Obviously, I'm not going to do 100% justice, or not even 50% justice. And just to make a little preface, that the questions that we ask today are the questions, as we said, that we all have and that we have for eternity. And it's not like we have answers, but it's just important to see how Moshe Rabbeinu asks, and in a sense, almost to see the response in that way of what's supposed to be our attitude in all these things. So let's start here. He says like this. Maybe we'll come back to this one. We'll do this another one. This is not part of this conversation. Okay, here we go. Okay, sorry, yes, 7, it's A4. Okay, so he says, another statement by Rabbi Yechanan in the name of Rabbi Yossi. So it's over here. So Amar Rabbi Yechanan Meshum Rabbi Yossi, Shleisha Dvarim Bikesh Moshe Milifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Moshe Rabbeinu actually was requesting three things from Hashem. And now we're going to see what was he really, because it's very confusing in the Pesukim. What is Moshe asking of Hashem? Not only what is he asking, so to speak, in a sense of questions, but what does he want from Hashem? And actually he says that Hashem granted them, according to most opinion, v'nosanlay, it was given to him. So the Gemara now states the first of the three requests. Bikesha Tishra Shechina Al Yisrael. The first thing that Moshe Rabbeinu asks is that he requests of Hashem that the divine presence rests on the Jewish people. V'nosanlay, and Hashem granted it. He granted him this request, as it says, Halloy belechtecha imanu, right? How then will it be known that I have found favor if you come with us? Actually, it's in the pasuk right after. So, and Hashem agreed, he's going to come. The second request, Bikesh shalei tishra shechina al oivdei koychavim. Sorry, we should have read another two psukim. Okay, he also requested of Hashem that the divine presence should not rest on the other nations of the world in the same way that he rests on the Jewish people. And with the Jewish people, he rests in a very open, revealed way. Our whole life is miraculous. Whereas with the nations of the world, of course Hashem rests his shechina on them, but it's through nature. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu says, v'niflinu aniva mecha. I'm sorry, it's two psukim. psukim from what we read. And I and your people will be made distinct. We will be different. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu wants. And the third request, and this is the hardest one almost in a sense, Bikesh l'haydiyai. Moshe Rabbeinu requests of Hashem, l'haydiyai drachav, that he made known the ways of Hashem, Shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What does that mean, the ways? And as they say here in the article, with regard to dispensing judgment, v'nasanlai, and he was given this. He was granted his request, as it says, Haydiani nas drachecha, make your ways known to me, and amar lefanav, Rabbeinu Shalaylam. So Moshe Rabbeinu said before Hashem, Master of the Universe, what was he asking? What did Moshe want to know? Mipnei ma yesh tzadik v'toivloi, the big question, as we say, that we all still ask. What is the reason that there are righteous people for whom things are good, v'yesh tzadik v'ralai, and then there are righteous people, and it's not very good for them. They have a quite difficult, challenging, bad lives. Yesh rosha v'tayvlai. On the other hand, there are wicked people for whom things are good, v'yesh rosha v'ralai, and then there are wicked people for whom things are bad. Doesn't sound like it's a very just world. It almost sounds, Moshe Rabbeinu is in a way saying that you are not involved in the day-to-day life of the people. Is that true? Are you? Are you involved in our lives? Does it make a difference how we live? Okay, let's see. Amar lai, Moshe. So Hashem says to Moshe, this is one answer, and just bear with me, I'm not going to leave this for sure, this part. So one answer is that this is one way that people say Hashem responded. Some of the Amiraim say, Tzadik v'toivloi, Tzadik ben Tzadik. Hashem said to Moshe, when you see a righteous person for whom things are good, it's a righteous person, the son of a righteous person. Tzadik v'ralai. But if you see a righteous person and things are not good for him, you know why? Because he's a tzadik ben Rasha. He's a tzadik, but his ancestors, so to speak, are wicked. Rasha v'tayvla. If you see a wicked person for whom things are good. Why? Because he is the wicked son of a righteous person, and Rasha v'ralai, and if you see a wicked man who things are bad for him, it's because he's a Rasha ben Rasha, he's a wicked man, the son of a wicked man. Now, the Gemara challenges this immediately, because this sounds like, and this is one of the big philosophical questions that many people have, does Hashem punish children for the sins of their fathers? And we are always told that that is not the case. Every person is an individual, and every person can only, so to speak, suffer on account of what he does or reap the rewards of what he does. In a sense, we create our own consequences, our own destiny. So how does this work? So the Gemara says like this, Amar Mar, Tzadik v'toivlai, Tzadik ben Tzadik, right? As we said, it's son of the Tzadik v'ralai, Tzadik ben. So how does it, is this so? Is your fortunes dependent upon the actions of his father? But don't we know, and he brings the pasuk paiket oven of abundim, visiting the sins of the fathers on the sons, and then we know, we say ubanim lo yumasu alavais, right, that the sons will not be put to death because of the fathers. This is another contradiction, and it's explained there that the only way that a son, so to speak, can suffer, if you want to say, because of their father is only if, as he says, hakisha eichsin masavisehem. It's not a question, he says, because this is only when the sons continue their father's sinful practices. So in that thing about Hashem visiting the sins of the fathers on the sons, it's only if the son continues. And that's why he says over here that that's impossible, that we can say that if somebody is a tzaddik and the son of a rasha, that's why he should suffer. If he's a tzaddik, that means he's not continuing in his father's ways, so he won't be punished. So as he says, so that's why we say, whereas this verse which states that the sons are not punished because of their father's sins, that refers to where the sons do not retain their father's sinful practices. So it's clear that a righteous son who does not follow the sinful ways of his father is not punished for the sins of his father. So therefore, how do you answer the question? Why is it? According to that, we definitely can't give this answer. So how could we answer? Why is it that somebody is a tzaddik and yet it looks like they're suffering in this world? So here the Gemara says, okay, you're right. I'll give another version. Maybe this is what Hashem said to Moshe. Tzaddik v'toivloi, tzaddik gomor. A righteous person for whom things are good is a completely righteous person. But if it's a tzaddik v'ralai, What does it mean if somebody is a tzaddik and there's some things that he's suffering with in this world? That's because it's true he's righteous, but einenu gomer, but he's not completely righteous. And therefore, and according to some opinions, what this means is that Hashem wants, because he's a tzaddik and because he's such a good person and he tries so hard, but he's not perfect, Hashem says better he should suffer in this world rather than in the world to come. And the same way in the reverse, if somebody is wicked and it looks like he has a good life, that's because he's not completely wicked. And Hashem says, I'd rather give him his rewards in this world. And if somebody is wicked and it's bad for him, it's because he's completely wicked. So that's the way we can reconcile, if you want to say, this thing. Now, just obviously, this is a very superficial, but this is a very just a tease of the big question. And the Mefarshim all explain and say that this philosophical question that Moshe Rabbeinu had, obviously he's not getting a complete answer for it, and none of us will ever have a complete answer. And we're going to see soon, because Hashem does say to Moshe Rabbeinu that I can reveal myself to you to a certain extent, but there's a lot of me that you will never understand. And there's a lot of Hashem that it's impossible for us limited people and the physical limited world can ever access the true greatness of God and the true wisdom and the operations of Hashem. Like the famous line is, Ilu yidaitiv hayisiv. If I would know God, I would be God. And we are not God, so we can't know God. But just to understand, I saw very beautiful, a small thing here. It says a very nice little explanation. Oh, sorry, just one other thing also. It says that according to some opinions, the famous one of the ksuvim is Eiv, in English, Job, however you say it, Eiv, who has the big questions of why people suffer in this world. And according to some opinions, it was Moshe Rabbeinu, who's the author of that sefer. He's the one that's struggling with all these questions and coming to certain philosophical ideas through it, which takes a lot of learning, as we know, tremendous depth. Its own million, it's not shiurim, it's actually experience, it's so much to delve into. But I just want to show you something I thought was quite interesting here in the bottom in the Gemara. They have in the art school, they have a very beautiful thing that the Chassam Sofer explains. He says that one of the ways that we can explain also this idea about being the tzaddik, the son of a tzaddik, or the son of a Rasha, he says, when facing deprivation, a righteous person is typically at an advantage over a wicked person. The righteous are in control of their physical desires and have accustomed themselves to living a restrained lifestyle. Moreover, they can always take comfort in their spiritual pursuits. In contrast, the appetites of the wicked are ultimately insatiable. If he has 100 assets, he wants 200, right? So therefore, he will bear the ravages of destitution severely. So he says, if a righteous person grew up in the household of a wicked person, he might still feel afflicted later in his life by a modest lifestyle, since he was raised with more, as he says, he had to lust for more. Thus, a righteous son of a wicked father may have a discontented, maybe a discontented righteous person. In other words, they're going to struggle more. Similarly, the wicked son of a righteous father was raised in a family that trains him to avoid extravagance, whatever his means. This training may rein in the wicked person's desires and enable him to remain content with whatever life is in store for him. So this was one way that the Chassam Sofer explains the parents and the sons of how it carries forth. Okay, just one way. But I wanted to share with you something beautiful before time is up and time is almost up. Oh, there's one, I'm just thinking, I think what I'm going to do, just let me see something here, 1 minute. I just want to share something, a very small thing, and we're going to develop it more next week. We just have another 5 minutes. There's a very, very interesting thing that I saw, beautiful, beautiful, written by Rabbi Sacks. He explained very beautifully, a whole thing about this whole chapter, how difficult this chapter is. And I just wanted to find it here. And he says something really magnificent about Moshe Rabbeinu's question. Like I say, we will develop it a little bit more next week, but I just don't want to leave it with this. I want to just share with you something that I felt was very beautiful and gives us something that we can hold on to, because all these philosophical questions are there and we will have them. And we'll still, you know, as we say, what's the famous, there's a story told about, unfortunately, somebody who, I think he was a Holocaust survivor, and they were sitting and they were grumbling, and obviously they weren't grumbling. They had valid concerns and all their pain that they suffered, and where was Hashem and everything. And then it's starting to get late in the afternoon, and they look at each other and say, oh, it's time to daven mincha. Because bottom line is, we serve Hashem. We don't understand. We do understand, but we serve Hashem. But I just want to show you something really, really beautiful. Like I said, I will say it more next time. But Rabbi Sacks explains beautifully that one of the big things that Moshe Rabbeinu is asking is he's asking philosophical questions, but his philosophical question is not so much to understand, as we say, why certain people suffer or why certain people don't suffer. It's more to understand, what is our relationship with Hashem? What does that mean? What's our relationship? Is it that Hashem is so big, so great, so awesome, that he runs the world in almost like this vast way? And because of his awesomeness and because of his greatness, we can't really have an intimate relationship with him? Or maybe it's something very different, Moshe Rabbeinu said. And this is what we're going to come to the conclusion at the end of the chapter. That with all of our questions, and with all our difficulties, and with all our challenges, what does Hashem want us to know? And what does Moshe Rabbeinu internalize? That Hashem is with us. As we can see, this is his big request. He doesn't want an angel. He doesn't want any remote control. He wants Hashem's presence with us. Because ultimately, the biggest comfort for the Jewish people and the biggest sense of purpose is the fact that we feel that Hashem is literally involved in our life day by day, moment by moment. And we're going to see that will come through this chapter. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu is begging Hashem to come close to Hashem, not just to do miracles once in a while. That's not good enough. We want to feel Hashem's presence day by day, moment by moment. I feel bad. The time is up and I didn't get to explain it properly, and we're leaving at a very... anyways, but we will continue next week in Ritz Hashem, and we'll see a little bit more depth to this whole idea. I know brings up a lot of questions. Just a very beautiful short thing I'll share quickly in the last 2 minutes, talking about Hashem being with us, and we'll see how that comes into these psukim. But I heard such a beautiful thought today that, sometimes Hashem does do miracles sometimes, but sometimes the miracles, we don't feel them as miracles, right? Life is not so perfect, so to speak. But I heard the person put it in a very cute way, but Hashem sends us messages, you know, he sends us texts. We just have to open up our phone and read it. And the example, this person was saying such a very nice story that he met somebody, and he says, this person's 100% normal. And he said to him, you know, Hashem has been sending me messages lately. So he's thinking, oh my gosh, is the person okay? And he says, what do you mean? And this person was sharing with him that he's a person, he owns restaurants. He actually owns one or two restaurants in Manhattan. And we all know that nowadays owning a restaurant is a very, very difficult thing. I mean, the rules are very strict and you can't open the restaurant. So obviously he would have lost, and the rent is extremely high there. So obviously financially it's terrible, terrible, terrible times. And he says to this, so he's sharing with his friend, the one who owns the restaurants, that initially, obviously, I was very worried and there's what to worry about. But he says something very interesting started to happen. Every few days, somebody would call me up, because New York is a big population, and they would say, you know, I'm making a simcha. So he says, really, you're making a simcha, but legally I can't open up the restaurant. I'm sorry. He says, no, you don't have to open up the restaurant. We don't have to do anything illegal for us, but what we would like is for you to prepare all the food. We'll do it 100% legally, and we'll make it worthwhile for you. So he says that it happened once, it happened again, it happened again. And he says, you know, he feels like, this was the words that this person used, he feels that Hashem is sending him text messages. But as the other man said, sometimes what we have to do is open our phone and actually read the messages. Because Hashem could send us the messages. And we know sometimes I'm like that. We don't notice the messages. So we have to, as we said with the people over here, we have to gaze hard and look for in the times when Hashem is more hidden, look for Hashem's presence, that he is there with us in our life. But I'm sorry, I'm leaving it really in the middle, and Amir Tzah